Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, we'll be talking with Hebrew University professor and air quality expert, Dr. Menachem Luria, about air pollution and your health.
Yeah, you know, Christy, in light of the recent events in Japan with the nuclear explosion, in light of all of the concerns about air pollution, we've never done a show really that focuses on this. And I think it's something our listeners, I know I'm really interested in.
I completely agree with that and looking forward to the conversation. But first, we've got some good research that matters.
We really do, Christy. We're going to be talking about the most common drugs that are used for diseases like heart failure and high blood pressure, and do patients take those drugs?
And what can we do to get patients to take their drugs?
Cash for meds. What do we think about that, about whether or not ways of cutting down elective deliveries? Can people choose when they want to deliver, or can out of convenience, or can we actually cut down on that and improve health?
And finally, about differences in ethnicity and which patient get the stronger drugs for arthritis.
Yeah, let's go into our very first ones, really, about medications. And our very first study that was in the American Journal of Medicine, where they looked at 20 different studies, over 376,000 people, and medications that could prevent heart disease or treat those that with heart disease, and how many people took those medicines.
Pretty remarkable. So for the people who were taking medicines to prevent heart disease, just half of those people were continuing to get their medications refilled over time. But the also striking.
Which is striking.
I mean, that's striking. Right. But for the people who had already had a heart attack, and these medicines we know, save lives. One out of three of those people continue to or stop getting their meds over time. So, I mean, it really shows. Since reading this, I've been doing a better job with my patients of really asking, which medicines are you taking? Are you continuing to take them? Making sure people know how important this is.
Right. And these are medicines like statins, and we know a lot of people who start them but then stop them. Medicines like aspirin, we know people who start them and then stop them.
Medicines
and high
for blood pressure that sometimes people say, oh, well, I don't feel bad anymore. Maybe I don't need to take them.
Yeah, there's all kinds of reasons why people may stop these medicines. But the reality is that you're right, Christy. I'm not so certain we do as good of a job as we can about having the conversation that, particularly because a lot of these medicines are people have to take for the rest of their lives. And that's a huge decision.
Well, and some of it may be money, in which case there are some generic medications that we could prescribe that would be less expensive. Maybe it's teaching of really understanding how important it is. Maybe it has to do with the side effects and a conversation between you and your doctor. You might be able to make some changes to reduce those side effects.
Yeah. So let's if you're given a new medication for your heart, have a conversation with your physician about how long you're going to be on this medicine and what your concerns are, and then maybe we can actually save some lives.
The next one is a study looking to see if you pay people to take their medicines, will they take them?
Well, Christy, First of all, I just want to get this on the table. I want to get paid for any medicine I need to take for the rest of my life. I think this is a great idea. Not really. I'm not so certain. Just joking.
Well, it is a little bizarre. But so there have been multiple studies, particularly in different populations and patients with HIV or substance abuse, to see if you provided weekly rewards of $5, $10 helped people keep on track with their medications.
Right. This was an article also in the American Journal of Medicine. That's not a journal we follow all that often, but these are two really important studies this week. And they looked at these different studies and how much people were given, frequently starting with a $5 grocery voucher to help people take their TB medication, but upwards of almost $100 a week that were available to people to be compliant, to take the medicine for a condition, and suggesting that maybe this is something we should be doing more often for other diseases, kind of like that high blood pressure one we just stated, maybe to encourage people to stay on those high blood pressure medications.
Yeah, the researchers found that people were most likely to stick to their medication if they could earn $50 or more per week by doing so. To me, it's a little hard to kind of get over the concept of being paid to take something that's going to help me.
Right. Well, the thought here, though, is if I've got tuberculosis and I don't take my TB drugs or HIV disease and I don't take my HIV drugs, I can infect you or loved ones. And I get the public health element of here, but it's a slippery slope,
sure,
in my opinion here.
I
think we need to look to other ways, because otherwise, should we be paying people to take vitamins, or should we pay them to take a diabetes drug or their insulin?
They're pay people to exercise.
Pay to be healthy.
Yeah,
it does pay to be healthy, but I don't think we should pay people to be healthy all the time.
Well, the bottom line for listeners out there is to take your medicines. If you don't want to take them or if you're having problems with them, do talk to your doctor.
Or find a study where they're paying.
Sounds good.
Let's talk about another research study, Christy, that has to do with, I think, something that I think you're going to feel really passionate about, an article that was in Obstetrics and Gynecology about trying to cut down on what is called medically unnecessary scheduled birth. What are those?
Well, so we have good data now saying that if someone's having a repeat C-section, for example, they know they're going to have a C-section, that waiting to do that until 39 weeks or later
with a normal pregnancy lasting 40 weeks.
Yes.
Okay.
Is of benefit to the baby. And so many hospitals are trying to make sure that they're not just scheduling C-sections out of convenience earlier without a good medical reason to do so.
Would this also be, though, for people who are going to have a normal birth at 40 weeks who don't want a C-section but come in early to get induced early?
Induced.
Would that be, you know, that they're given a medication at 37 weeks to have the baby early because they have vacation planned at 40 weeks?
Right, yeah. It talk about a slippery slope. This really is, because, you know, induction has its risks to the baby and to increase the potential for a C-section.
Convenient for the mother or perhaps the family, but maybe unsafe for a baby. And so a lot of places and hospitals say, let's try to cut down on this. And this was a group effort among 20 Ohio hospitals that said, we're going to start reporting on the rates of these medically unnecessary scheduled births, kind of like a competition between hospitals. Didn't tell the hospitals how to cut down on these, but we're going to start reporting and comparing.
Well, and the thing that I like is that, one, whenever you work together with multiple hospitals and have a little competition, things do tend to get better. Doctors are competitive people.
Not us.
but you know, this is important work that will benefit moms and babies. And I don't think a lot of people, because so many people get C-sections or so many people get induced, really realize that it is beneficial to wait until the baby is full term.
Even the doctor, it could be the doctor saying, you know, I'm going on vacation in 2 weeks. Why don't we deliver it early?
Right. Then that's just not appropriate.
Yeah. Well, we have our last research that also isn't appropriate. And this is a discrepancy in the treatment of rheumatoid arthritis, in this case for African Americans, that they're not getting the same drugs that have been shown to benefit rheumatoid arthritis as the Caucasian population.
It's pretty striking. Even when they took into account the severity of the patient's arthritis, the researchers found that African Americans who had the condition were half as likely to be on the more potent anti-rheumatic drugs or the stronger drugs that work for rheumatoid arthritis compared with there were more people on the less potent ones.
Right. And these newer drugs have not been out there that long, but they've been out there long enough to allow the most of the population to have access to it. And in this particular study published in Arthritis Care and Research, appropriately called, these were patients that were on Medicare. So theoretically, they all have Medicaid, the same kinds of barriers to taking it, and you can adjust for income and other elements. So there is a problem here, one of which they say may be that the African-American population may not have access to the physicians that are comfortable or proficient in prescribing these types of drugs.
Well, and when they compared it, 16% of white patients took these medicines, 20% of the Hispanic patients with rheumatoid arthritis, so higher for the Hispanic population, and then only 9% of African-American patients. So something's going on there.
So my take-home point here is if you know someone who has rheumatoid arthritis or you yourself have it, you really should be talking with your doctor about whether these drugs are right for you, regardless of your ethnicity. But certainly, if you're African-American, make sure you're getting this standard of care, which may be these particular medications.
So we've had a chance to talk a little bit about medications for arthritis, talk about medically unnecessary scheduled births.
About the right drugs and staying on the right drugs to prevent heart attacks, and also about Christy and I want to get paid if we're taking any of our medications. Not really.
Okay, that concludes the Research That Matters portion of the show. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Menachem Loria about air pollution and your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with Dr. Menachem Loria about air pollution and your health. And really very happy to have with us Dr. Loria, who's professor of atmospheric sciences and air quality at the Hebrew University in Israel, joining us. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Loria.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for being with us. You know, Adam and I have been excited to have this conversation just because it's something that we don't talk about enough in relation to health and wellness. I wonder if we could jump right in and hear a little bit about your path and your passion for air quality.
Well, actually, I've been involved in air quality research for almost 40 years since I started my academic career at the Hebrew University almost 40 years ago.
Wow.
I spent many visits and a good number of years in the U.S. working together with some U.S. scientists trying to bring the state-of-the-art knowledge in air quality into our country and to bring the know-how and also to help with educating people about air quality and to get public awareness about air quality issues that are that's been recognized as a problem in Israel more and more in recent years.
Well, we know that air quality is something that's universal, kind of like concern over water. And I guess let's just ask, what are really some of the main sources of air pollution? Because I think when we think about it, we think about, oh, we can smell if you're around coal plants or hog farms. You can smell something. But are those the major sources of air pollution that we should worry about?
Basically, yes. I mean, the major sources of air pollution are those sources that are using most energy, like coal-fired power plants. Those are the main sources of air pollution. Specifically for global warming, but also because coal is not a clean fuel. And in recent years, it's been done much more about cleaning the emissions from coal-burning power plants. But historically, those were the main sources of air pollution, bringing into the air particulates, sulfur, nitrogen oxide, and then causing all the formation of the other photochemical smog, which result from chemistry that takes place in the air.
Well, speaking of coal, Speaking of coal as the biggest source of air pollution in the United States, what do we know about the effects of coal on health?
Well, first of all, I mean, the thing is that the power generating industry has gone a very, very long way in cleaning up the act. And today, in all major countries, the main problem from using coal is the carbon dioxide, which is a problem in terms of the global warming. But historically, they were responsible for a lot of the particulates, and we know that particulates are the number one cause for health effects, so actually early cases of death of people. You know that in areas where we have high levels of particulates, the death rate is higher than in areas that are cleaner.
So when we talk about particulates, we're talking about the density of particles that are potentially contaminants or potentially things that are adverse to health. Is that the same thing as smog, or how do we really understand what is smog and why it's created?
Well, there are two types of particulates. Those what we call primary particulates, those that are emitted from combustion sources. And actually today we are mostly concerned about diesel engines and less from power plants. And these are particulates that are emitted directly from the source. And the second type of particulates that are also small particulates and are also pose a problem from health effects, they have significant health effects, are particulates that are formed in the air. So you have the precursors that are emitted into the air, and then through some chemical processes, new small particulates are being created, and those are the ones that are also a cause concern from the standpoint of health effects.
Are those the things?
One of the things that we found out in Israel in the research that we've been doing for many, many years was looking into transport of these particulates that are being emitted from sources from far away. And, you know, as you said, there are no borders for air pollution. And especially 20 years back, before the collapse of communism, there were many, many sources in Eastern Europe that emitted uncontrolled pollution. And we saw in Israel very high levels of particulate sulfate that came from those sources. Fortunately, I wouldn't say that this problem has been solved, but in recent years we see a lower level, almost 50% of what we used to see some 20 years ago.
So if we're thinking about, I've traveled I remember going to Santiago a few years ago and going up onto a mountain and looking down on the city of 6, 8, 10 million people and just seeing what was smog, this whole cloud, and you hear about in these major cities in Mexico City. What are we now doing in the research that really seeks to say this is a major health problem, and what can we do to help eliminate essentially smog in urban environments?
Well, as I said, it is easier to eliminate pollution if you control the source. And as I said, power plants are now highly controlled, and the emissions from power plants, even in countries like India, are extremely lower than relative to what they used to be 20, 30 years back. And they have devices that control particulates, devices that control sulfur, devices that control nitrogen. So basically, the emission is almost only water and CO2. But we have other problems, especially when we talk about big cities. These are automobile emissions. And in the third world, those emissions are not controlled. A lot of these countries do not impose pollution control on automobiles. And even if they do impose them, they are not actually enforcing the emissions. And That's the main problem in mega cities in developing countries. That, you know, you have the combination of high emissions and topographical situation that is not allowing good ventilation, like in Mexico City. And the result is high levels of smog, particulates, and also the formation of ozone, which is the other cause for serious health problems.
Well, that was actually something we were hoping to talk about today is ozone. What do we know about the state of the ozone?
Well, I mean, there is the good ozone and the bad ozone. The good ozone is the ozone that is in the stratosphere, some 15 to 50 kilometers above the Earth. And basically, the situation is stable and, if not improving, somewhat. Because of a lot of international actions that eliminated the usage of chemicals that are responsible for the destruction of the ozone. When we go to the lower atmosphere, ozone is bad because in the upper atmosphere, ozone is acting like the sunglasses for the Earth. It eliminates the dangerous UV radiation. And in the lower atmosphere, ozone is very active, and it's a cause for a lot of lung disease. Actually, when we have high levels of ozone, then we can see that there is a higher rate of people that have onset of a lot of existing diseases, especially asthmatic people, and that is mostly a result from automobile emissions. Automobile emissions, together with the hydrocarbons that are emitted from either natural or anthropogenic sources, and they, together under strong solar radiation, generate these chemicals that is significantly toxic both to human and also to plants.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but I'm seeing a common theme here, which is the automobile and the emissions, but also a little bit of progress. But when we come back, I know we also really want to talk about other contaminants in the air, and we'll want to certainly talk about the Fukushima accident last year and what happened in the air and the concerns that we should or should not have. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Menachem Luria, about air pollution and your health. We'll be right back with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Hebrew University professor and air quality expert, Dr. Menachem Luria, about air pollution and your health. And before the break, we said we were going to come back and talk a little bit about the nuclear blast in Japan and how that has affected health. Fill us in.
Yes. What happened when you have this kind of problem like Fukushima, the temperature inside the core of the nuclear reactor gets very high, and basically what they want to do is to cool it off, and they have many mechanisms, at least three levels of mechanisms that cool off the core of the nuclear plant. So even when the nuclear reaction ends, there's still a lot of heat inside the core of the nuclear plant, which caused a meltdown of the fuel and the surrounding of the fuel. And the temperature gets to be very high. That causes the formation of the collapse of the cement. And that the cement is break down to very, very small particulates. So the heavy particle, and then all the radioactivity is absorbed into these particles. So what happened is that in the near field, near the power plant, the big particles are settling down, and that caused the high radiation around the nuclear plant. And that's why they evacuate people from a radius of up to 30 miles from the nuclear plant, which is remains dangerous for many, many years to come, like we know from Chernobyl. Now, the smaller particles can travel many, many miles, at, almost like gases, and they can travel all over and carry with them radioactivity. So we can detect, when something like this happens, we can detect radioactivity thousands of miles from the source. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the concerns when we talk about using nuclear energy, and this is something that we found out that happened both in Chernobyl, and we found some traces of radioactivity from Chernobyl in Israel after that incident. We haven't heard anything from Fukushima as far as we're concerned in Israel, but there are evidences that some radioactivity actually was detected thousands of kilometers from the site. While it is not extremely dangerous, it is very, very uncomfortable. And that's the main reason why Japan has decided to cut back on its nuclear plans. And I believe that other countries are taking some second thoughts about using nuclear plants, because if we have two major events in 50 years, this is way too much. And while we have a lot of very good engineers that can understand exactly what happens when the power plant works as it was supposed to, we know very little about what could happen when there is an incident like what we had in Fukushima. Hmm. And this is a major reason for concern about the usage of nuclear energy.
Well, you know, I think you did a really nice example of boiling down something incredibly complex to really understandable terms. One of the things that I heard, and if I'm sure if I was in Japan, I'd be worried about, is the air pollution, the radiation settling down into the soil and then the cows eating it and the milk having then radioactivity. And this linkage between what is in the air and then into the food we eat. And I know you've done a lot of research on mercury. And we hear a lot about, we're always worried about the food we eat and mercury contamination. Tell us a little bit, because I know this is a big area of research. Tell us about mercury contamination in the air and what do we know?
Well, it's interesting. Mercury is actually a very stable compound. And, you know, we all know that dentists are using a lot of mercury to do fillings. But it is a stable compound. And as an elemental, mercury is not all that toxic, but because it is not reactive. But when you can bring it into some reactive form, in other words, to bring it into a compound, then the mercury will become extremely toxic. And we know that when we talk about mercury contamination in fish, we don't talk about the fish that are saturated, or they have a lot of elemental mercury, but it is mercury in compound. And these are the elements, these are the form that is actually remains in the flesh of the fish. So the question was, how does the mercury get into the biosystem? And there has been research for many years, because we have low levels of mercury all over the world. Actually, when we inhale a liter of air, actually we inhale 1.5 picograms of mercury, which is a very little amount.
Thank God.
It's still measurable. And the question is, how do we get it? I mean, the main source of mercury into the air is burning coal. Coal contains 0.1 ppm of mercury, between 0.1 and 0.2 ppm of mercury. And it is estimated that between 1,000 and 2,000 tons of mercury are emitted every year into the air from burning coal. Now, that mercury has a very long life in the air. But when it gets into contact with some compounds, explicitly with bromine compounds, the mercury is actually oxidized and being converted into a compound that is now deposited easily into the water body and then converted into what we call dimethyl mercury, which is the toxic form of mercury that is accumulated in fishes.
Mm.
So what we know is that that process, we knew that it happens in the Arctic. At some stage in the Arctic, there is a release of bromine compound, and that is how the mercury is being oxidized. At least that was considered as one of the main mechanisms. Now in Israel, we have the Dead Sea. And the Dead Sea has bromine levels that are almost 200 times higher than in the open ocean. And the bromine is released into the air. And one of the more interesting research that we did, we found out that actually over the Dead Sea, we have a very rapid reaction between the mercury that is generally everywhere and these bromine compounds. And we actually could measure the process, and we could, under natural laboratory conditions, we were able to evaluate the process that is probably responsible for the conversion of elemental stable mercury into reactive mercury that is being deposited into the ocean.
And so how then do we reverse this process? And I guess it gets us into one of our last questions, which is kind of, where are we going in the future? And what you know, is this a bright future or a future that is mixed with warnings here?
Well, the good news is that mercury, the usage of mercury began to decline in the 1980s, because until then, mercury was very important in many, many applications. And all these applications, actually, we found out better way to do the same thing, like batteries and a lot of measuring devices. Actually, all the classical chemistry was done using a lot of mercury. When I was a student, I had many, many kilos of mercury in the laboratory. And now there are devices that do not use this element. Also, fillings and other things that we've been using. And if we will eliminate the usage of coal, then we will not have any more, or at least we can reduce immensely the amount of mercury that evaporates. I mean, mercury had relatively high vapor pressure. And within 50 years, the levels of mercury will decrease significantly.
So you've talked about some major successes in air quality control and steps to improve emissions for power plants, reduce coal, reduce auto emissions from the source. What can we do as people and individuals across the world? What is the take-home message to our listeners of what we can do to improve air quality in our world?
Well, I mean, first of all, we have to make sure that our automobile is in good shape and they don't emit anything, not only in the annual test like we have in Israel, but throughout the year. And then we have to put more pressure on the automakers to go into cleaner technologies, and now cleaner technologies are available. I mean, if we have electric cars, we have less emissions.
Mm-hmm.
And those emissions are being done at the power plant, and it is easier to control one power plant than to control 1 million cars. So actually moving into electric cars is a big step in cleaning the atmosphere.
Well, we want to thank you, Dr. Menachem Luria, who's at Hebrew University, for sharing a research that goes across continents, just like air pollution can, but also leaving us with some actions and some hope and sharing your expertise with our listeners in this region of the world as well. Thank you so much for being our guest today.
That's my pleasure.
We're going to take a short break, but coming on up on House Calls, we'll answer questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show, Adam and I are going to take a few minutes to talk about your health questions and concerns. We got some from a variety of different places today.
Yes, we have a couple emails where people send us questions to yourhealth@unc.edu, and we've got some call-ins as well. Let's listen to our very first question today from a listener about a built-in environment. This is an email, Christy.
The email question says, how does a built environment, i.e. buildings, sidewalks, etc., affect one's social environment and health?
You know, that's a really good question. And I've heard, interesting, Christy, I was up at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City recently, and I saw an exhibit of just this. I was walking around with my son, and we saw in the exhibit all of these things happening all over the country where architects are getting together, and they're trying to design areas within urban developments that really take into account a whole host of, I guess, environmental conditions that might relate to how people live, work, feel, act.
Well, we've already talked about air quality today, and that's certainly a part of it. But also thinking about your access to physical activity, access to food and healthy choices, injuries if the area is not safe. There are lots of different factors that can go into health related to your built environment.
Right. Does the environment have exercise facilities within an easy distance and that are safe for people? Where is homelessness occur, and how can mm-hmm. you reduce that homelessness, crime, safety? It's amazing how the visual and the architectural and the structural issues that are important from housing. So I was not aware of this until recently. I thank our listener for really writing in here, because I think this is an important area that as providers, we probably aren't even aware of.
I would agree with that. Let's take our next house call question.
Hi, my name is Julie Heining. I am breastfeeding my 6-month-old, and a lot of my colleagues have been talking about baby-led weaning. It's a book I read about introducing solid foods to your baby rather than the traditional puree diet. I was wondering what you thought about that.
Well, Christy, this is an interesting area that I wonder how much research there is right now about baby-led weaning. But I know that there's a lot of interest in it.
There is. And I think part of it's because there's a lot of stress and unclear instructions for moms of how much should you be feeding solid foods and when and which ones. And it gets to be a confusing time.
Well, I know that it doesn't have to be just those bottles that are in. That I was fed by my mother, you have those little small Gerber bottles, and you open up and you introduce the foods, the peas and the pureed carrots. Mm-hmm. Clearly, we've gone beyond that. That's the only way that infants need to be fed when you start giving them solid foods.
Right. And I mean, all a baby needs in that first year of life is breast milk. And if you're not doing breast milk, then formula. And these solid foods that we introduce at around 6 months of age are supplemental to that. And everyone's very excited to give their baby new foods. But this concept in this book of baby-led weaning is sort of exploding the concept that everyone has to be spoon-fed pureed foods, but saying that babies
or there's can start. There's a right way that we as parents have to introduce these foods versus giving the children, even mm-hmm. at that age, maybe a little controversial here, mm-hmm. but giving them autonomy,
right.
giving them choice in what they're going to take and how much they're going to take and when they decide to take it, whether it's 6 months or even a year.
Right, and sort of to skip the pureed step and go straight to some self-feeding when ready. The thing, I mean, again, I agree with you. There's not a lot of evidence to prove one strategy is any better than another. I think the focus on continuing to breastfeed and give formula for a year is really important. I like that in this book they really stress the family meal time, to sit down together as a family. And
don't
take
rush
your time.
This process, because it could take a while.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are lots of different thoughts about it.
I'm open to it.
I am too.
I'm open to learning more. I'm open to learning from our listeners here.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe seeing some research here. Maybe there's some drawbacks we don't know about. But
right. I think if it feels right to you and you've talked with your doctor about it and baby's growing well, then it's probably a good thing.
Well, thinking of good things, our next listener had a really bad allergic reaction. And this is their story. They sent us an email that said, I was recently hospitalized for an allergic reaction and my face started to swell, then my lips, face, neck, and shoulders. After this episode, my hands started to itch and burn, and then I had hives. The hives went from my lower body all the way to my feet. My doctor thought it was viral and believed I may have had a cold. Actually, I may have had an earache or sore throat or even seasonal allergies. But on that day of my reaction, I did have a pastrami sandwich and Thai chili sauce. I also ran a fever when I was hospitalized. Which one of all of these things could it be? Could it have been all of them?
Wow. I'm sorry. This sounds like a terrible experience to have all those hives and itching, and it sounds really scary. So sorry that you went through that. Thank you for writing us. The answer to exactly what it is, unfortunately, we may never know.
It's A, B, C, or D.
Yeah, it could be all of the above. It's possible that you did have some sort of a virus that caused a rash, with the fever being sort of making it seem like it could be an infection, or that you had that or a cold, and you also happen to have an allergic reaction.
One of the things I would worry about, sometimes in the chili sauces or Thai chili sauce could have had peanuts in there, and developing a peanut allergy could be very serious and sometimes even, you know, fatal for some people. So I would really worry about, do you have any reaction like this when you have peanuts? Sometimes shellfish gets contaminated, and shellfish would be another common area. I've not heard of a whole lot of reactions with pastrami.
No, but that's also possible. So for one allergic reaction, you may just have to go forward and pay attention to those types of symptoms again in case it were to happen.
But this was serious.
Yeah, this was really serious. There are allergy and immunology specialists that you can see that'll do tests to try to identify what you're allergic to give you some more clarity.
Right. And I think we have an upcoming guest in a few weeks. We actually, the head of allergy at UNC allergy program, talking about food allergies. So maybe we can ask him about this particular question. Let's listen to our very last house call today.
So my name is Lacey, and my husband's been having some issues with bulging discs in his back. And a lot of the suggestions that have been made to him are regarding surgery, and he's really not interested in surgical options. So I was wondering if there are any regenerative therapies regarding bulging discs that you know anything about.
Bulging discs. I wish that we could see all the listeners out there and wonder, you know, how many people listening to the show right now have low back pain related to discs. It's really very common. It sounds like your husband's really had a time of it.
And, you know, surgery is not usually one of our first, second, or third options, because they will heal with non-surgically, but there are conditions under which you might need to have surgery. But it sounds like in this particular case, you don't want to have it either. So the question is, what about these new therapies that are out there that people talk about, this back regeneration? Sounds great.
I'll be interested in your thoughts, Adam, but from what I saw, there are some spine centers offering disc regeneration, but there's not a whole lot of evidence at this point that it makes a real difference for people.
Well, what do they talk about in it? I mean, because I've heard even these newer therapies, you know, potentially using stem cells and trying to regenerate these progenitor back cells. And I know that therapy is not main stage yet, and there aren't the controlled trials to recommend it, and I think it would be relatively expensive. I suspect there are other sorts of chemical ways that people are, and researchers or these spine centers are talking about trying to regenerate.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think if you happen to live near one of those spine centers and that's the only option, it may be a safe thing to try. But there, at this point, it's all so preliminary with animal studies and early studies that we don't know if it works. There are other
things. And the side effects.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
The other things to think about are just some of the regular things like acupuncture, behavioral medicine, where you can sort of do a cognitive behavioral therapy. Physical therapist or a chiropractor.
Yeah, I think the standard treatments right now are what we would recommend. You know, stay tuned. We appreciate the question. And certainly getting some relief is in order. And hopefully you'll get some relief. And we want to thank all of our listeners and those who've emailed questions for us today. We hope we've answered questions important to your health.
And we want you to write us, email us, call us. Lots of different options.
Go to our health application and search for Your Health, all one word, on Google as well as the iPhone.
Mm-hmm. And visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. We want to thank the staff of WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Menachem Luria.
We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. We'll talk with you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM, WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM, WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.